This hour of the Jason Rand Show is brought to you by Primary Residential Mortgage, PRMI. Lots of news is happening all around the world and right here at home. So let's find out what's trending.
What's trending in Seattle?
Another business ditched the city of Seattle. And unfortunately, no one in this region will benefit, because usually when we have these kinds of stories, they'll go to Bellevue, right? Maybe they'll go to Kent. They'll go to Everett, maybe Tacoma or Bothell or Woodinville. But in this case, it's going to Tucson, Arizona. They have decided over at Wow Studios, this luxury sportswear brand, to move their headquarters from Seattle to Tucson. Why did they decide to do that? Really, really, really bad leadership in Seattle. Joey Rodolfo is the head designer and co-owner. He spoke to KOLD Television to explain in part why they're moving out.
Seattle, in a matter of 6 months, became, you know, just an incredibly tough place to do business. And to this day, our business is still shut down there.
Why did it become such a difficult place to do business? He's quoted in this piece as saying, Seattle was decimated by the riots. It's unfortunate that we have a mayor in City Hall that was not there for businesses to protect us from the looting. He decided to call it quits because of bad leadership. A city that allows its businesses to be destroyed by criminal activists because the leaders, in air quotes, are too terrified to call out the criminal activists. They are terrified. Part of the problem is folks like Jenny Durkin and this entire city council and so many other politicians, for the longest time, refused to make a difference between the peaceful Black Lives Matter protesters and the violent Antifa agitators, using the Black Lives Matter movement to give them some cover for their violence, for their destruction, for their fringe activism. And as a result, we are out of yet another business, a business that in this case is projected to add not just 50 jobs to Tucson, but hundreds of millions of dollars to the economy over the next decade. Kind of feels like Seattle right now can use hundreds of millions of dollars over the next decade, because we got word officially of something that I reported 2 weeks ago when I was on with Fox Business. Amazon announced late yesterday that they've extended their work from home procedure, policy, system, schedule, whatever you want to call it, into at least next summer. At least June of 2021. They're doing this at the same time we've basically heard the same exact thing coming from Starbucks and Google and Zillow and Facebook, all extending their remote workforce capabilities. In fact, we already know that generally speaking, even after the pandemic, you're going to get companies like a Starbucks or an REI or Microsoft to be able to work from home a certain period of the year. Now, I think it's really easy to look at this story and just judge it on the surface. This is probably a move because of the coronavirus. We're not ready to bring people back into the office. We don't want to risk any outbreak in our South Lake Union, downtown Seattle offices. We're just going to play it safe. And the second that you can come back to the office, oh, we're going to have you run back and we'll welcome you with open arms. That's not what this is about. This is how it will be masked. What is it really about? Jumpstart Seattle. Remember that? The payroll tax. Despite the fact that we're in a pandemic, the Seattle City Council decided to pass a payroll tax that targeted 800 businesses in all, but it was called the Amazon tax. Because the intent was to go after Amazon. But this tax, poorly written, had a little bit of a loophole in it. Do you know what that loophole is?
No, I don't know what the loophole is.
Should I tell you what that loophole is?
As a good radio host, I would hope that you would tell me what the loophole is. The
payroll tax does not apply to employees who both work from home at least 50% of the time and live outside of Seattle. You don't have to pay the payroll tax on those employees. Now, up until this point, you certainly have a substantial number, but not the overwhelming majority of employees of Seattle at the Seattle headquarters for Amazon living outside of Seattle. But you have some, right? The ones who have families. And they're not the sort of young coder who just moved to Seattle from out of state. You've got a bunch of people who make good money, who are raising a family, who will live in Kirkland or Puyallup or Issaquah, because you can get a lot more space there. And you're making good money, so you can afford some of the pricier homes in Kirkland and Issaquah. And if you don't want to spend all that money, you can go to Puyallup, get really nice, large properties for good value. What's happening now that these businesses have adopted a remote workforce? More people are realizing, oh, I guess I don't need to live in Seattle, where it's really, really expensive. It turns out that for the $1,700 I'm spending right now on a 400-square-foot apartment studio, $1,700, oh my gosh, I get something like 2,200 square feet in Renton and Tukwila? You mean I can get a nicer place, pay about the same in Bellevue, but not have to deal with all the homelessness and crime? I'm out. If you're going to let me work from home, I'm in. I'll work from home the entire time. So people are going to start to leave Seattle to save money and for better quality of life. What does that do to the Jumpstart Seattle tax? Kills it, doesn't it? Jumpstart Seattle was intended to go after Amazon. They are making moves very clearly to get out of having to pay that ridiculous, onerous tax. And the thing to keep in mind in the back of your head this entire time, remember the person who's behind this, Teresa Mosqueda, who's running for mayor. She just hasn't announced it yet. And this entire council said this is not going to hurt businesses here. This is only going after the big businesses, and they can afford it. Amazon can afford this. Except the money is not coming into the coffers because Amazon is moving their people out. And when people work from home, what does it do to these small businesses that you promised would not get hurt, that rely on Amazon having people in the offices in large numbers so they have customers to serve? Those businesses hurt as well. The restaurants, the coffee shops, the small boutique retailers, they are hurting even more right now because Amazon doesn't have their workers there. Like we say, none of these issues happen in a bubble. They're all connected, and it's all bad news for Seattle. 1-800-465-8770 if you want to text me and join the conversation. When we come back, Dr. Art Kode is running for state senate in the 1st Legislative District. He's going to make his pitch. Let's find out what else is trending.
What's trending? Let's get political.
Ballots are in hand, and folks living in the 1st Legislative District here in Washington are asked with a simple question. Do you want to go with an uber progressive incumbent who was appointed to the seat, or do you want to be represented by a Republican medical doctor to help take us through this pandemic? The 1st Legislative District includes Bothell and Maltby, Briar and Mount Lake Terrace, and part of Kirkland. Joining me on the line is the Republican challenger, Dr. Arthur Kode. Welcome to the show, Art. Appreciate it.
Hi, Jason. It's great to be with you and your listeners.
So how would you advise the governor in tackling the coronavirus? Maybe first tell us how you would have in the beginning and how you would now.
Well, you know, I actually agree with what Governor Inslee did in the beginning. You know, in the very beginning, we didn't really know the properties of this virus. We didn't know just how lethal it was and who was at greatest risk. But you know, after a few weeks and certainly after about 3 months, it became rather clear that this virus was not as lethal as we thought. And it also became clear that there was a stratification of risk primarily based on age and, to a lesser extent, you know, comorbid conditions, like if a person has diabetes or cancer or, you know, lung or heart disease, that sort of thing. And so really, after about 3 months into this, Jason, I would have departed from the governor and basically would have said we should have opened up society as a whole, taking, of course, appropriate precautions, you know, social distancing, masks, you know, keeping surfaces cleaned and disinfected, that sort of thing, to slow the spread of the virus. But, you know, not locking everything down, but then really focusing on our high-risk population and taking strenuous measures to protect that group of people. So people greater than 80. So in our state, Jason, about 51% of the deaths from COVID have been in people 80 years of old and older. Okay, so if you're above 80 or above, you've got a pretty significant risk from this virus. But below 80, it drops off pretty fast, and below 60, it's really not very great at all. So focus on those at risk. Long-term care facilities like nursing homes are at great risk, Jason. About 55% of the deaths in our state have occurred in long-term care facilities. So we really need to focus on those facilities, and there are things we could do to make them much safer. I don't think we've done enough there.
So, you know, the argument that we get from either the Inslee administration or Democrats, and certainly from teachers' unions, that when it comes to reopening the schools, even though, as you'll note, that if you are a child, a school-aged kid, unless you've got some underlying medical health issue, the risk is infinitesimal, right? I mean, it is incredibly, incredibly low to have a negative reaction to the coronavirus. But the claim is that not only does it deliver the disease to a teacher who could be in one of those groups where their age puts them at risk, but it can bring it home to grandma and grandpa. So what's your response to that?
Yeah, that's a great question. We should reopen the schools effective immediately, Jason. Let me lay out the data for you there. So if you look at our state's data as published by the Department of Health on the state, you know, website, in the age group 0 to 19, which would include our school-age kids, there have been zero deaths reported. Zero. Okay. That's for starters. Now, with respect, so, and this is why the American Academy of Pediatrics and the Centers for Disease Control have recommended opening schools. Okay. So our state is way out of line with the official recommendations of the country's most authoritative bodies on the matter. That's number one. Number two, let's talk about teachers who might be at high risk. Let's say you have a 64-year-old teacher who's got diabetes and heart and lung disease, and they're clearly going to be at higher risk than most people. There's no reason that we can't make some provisions for people like that. Maybe they teach from home. Maybe they take a sabbatical. Maybe they play an alternative role in the schools, like maybe, you know, assisting with curriculum development or something like that. But there's no reason we can't make reasonable accommodations for these people, because certainly we don't want to put anybody at risk. That is not the goal, and it doesn't have to happen.
Just joining us, we're talking with Dr. Art Codé. He is running for the first legislative seat in, or first legislative district seat over in the Bothell, Maltby, Montlake Terrace area. He's running up against Derek Stanford, who is the incumbent, although Stanford was appointed after the previous representative had stepped aside for a job in the private sector. I want to talk just a little bit more about schooling, but I want to jump to college-aged students. The governor yesterday came out with even more restrictive mandates for college students because he's seeing an uptick, a surge in positive cases surrounding either sororities and fraternities or campus life in general. The information we never seem to get is whether or not the students who are getting the coronavirus, which of course we don't want people to get the coronavirus, but are they going to hospitals? Are there any increases in deaths? Are we at a point where they are suffering significantly as a result, or are they kind of just getting the virus and then again, because of their age and general health, they're getting over it rather quickly?
The latter. You know, they're just getting it over quickly. You know, if we look at, again, the statistics on that, and we look at the percentage of deaths, of the total deaths, we've had about just under 2,300 deaths in our state from coronavirus. If you look at the age group 20 to 39, which would be pretty much the, you know, university and college population, that'd be most of it. That accounts for only 2% of the deaths in our state. So again, very, very, very small. And again, you know, we can have self-selection. So if you're a college-age student and you have leukemia and you're getting chemotherapy and so you're immunocompromised, you probably don't want to be on campus. But if you're just your average, typical university or college student, you can be on campus. You yeah. don't need to worry. Wear your mask, take your precautions, and you're going to be fine.
So let's move on a little bit to a related topic in that the economy in Washington State has obviously taken a hit due to the mandates that shut down the economy. Now, the good news is that it is starting to come back, and we went from what seemed like a $9 billion hole to maybe $2.5-3.5 billion hole in our budget. Anyway, obviously that's a lot, but it certainly indicates that that swing indicates that things are getting back to where we need them to be faster than probably folks thought was going to happen. What would you recommend if you were the state senator for the first legislative district to get the ball moving even faster?
Well, we need a special session of the state legislature. And just like my opponent and I are sharply in contrast to one another regarding schools, my opponent wants the schools closed. I want them open. By the way, he gets money from the Washington State Education Association. That PAC donated to his campaign. They and other educational associations and unions endorse him. So he's got a conflict of interest there, which is obvious. You can go to the PDC and see all this. We also diverge on this question about the state budget. And Jason, he and I were together at an interview with the Seattle Times editorial board about a month or so back. And they asked us the question, should the state have a special session of the legislature to deal with this budgetary issue resulting from the shutdown? And he said no. I said yes. And he said, you know, what will we do at such a session? I mean, what do you think we're going to do? Write a new budget? He was sort of being snarky about it. And I'm thinking to myself, that's exactly what we should do, is write a new budget, because we need to. And a few weeks later, we both had an interview with the Everett Herald, and he had come around and changed his mind. And when the same question was asked, he said, yeah, we should have a special session. And I commended him for taking my advice on that matter. But yes, Jason, we need a special session of the state legislature with the governor involved so that we can rewrite our budget to accommodate for the shortfall. We need to immediately end the lockdown so that our economy can get going, because that's the best and fastest way to increase our revenue, is just to let the economy yeah. reopen. And that's just a no-brainer. I think anybody can see the wisdom there.
Again, you know, looking at the legislative district that you seek to represent as state senator, when we're talking about, you know, Maltby and Mount Lake Terrace and Bothell, these places are not deeply blue. And yet Derek Stanford, who is the Democrat, could very easily be described as a Seattle-style progressive. I mean, just looking at his Twitter feed, he's retweeting Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren. So he's not someone who I think can best represent this particular district. So if you live in this district, make sure that you're voting. Dr. Art Codé is running against the incumbent Democrat. Let's make this particular legislative district let it return to its roots of being a little bit more red than what is currently on the books there right now. Dr. Art Codé, thank you so much for coming on. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Jason.
Absolutely. You're listening to The Jason Rants Show. When we come back, we're going to get into the big local right here on KTTH.
Happening now on KTTH.
Welcome back to the Jason Rants Show. Normally, we do our big local segment here, and perhaps we'll get into it shortly, but we are learning that the FBI is scheduled to hold an announcement on what it's calling a major election security issue. This, according to multiple sources. The expectation is that this press briefing is going to happen in the next several moments or so. When it does happen, we will be carrying it live. As these things generally go, they're usually not on time. And it's unclear what the major election security issue is going to be. There's lots of speculation that the news conference is going to include not only the FBI director, Christopher Wray, but... And this is where it comes down to some of the speculation is that DNI Director of National Intelligence John Ratcliffe, the Assistant Attorney General for National Security John Demers, and a member of the Department of Homeland Security is going to be there as well. And that leads to some speculation that this might involve some kind of election security issue with meddling from overseas or some kind of election security issue that is domestic, right? We just don't know what it is. Now, the assumption is if you're going to call an FBI announcement and have those kinds of players, it's not just some small issue of, you know, someone stealing a couple ballots. And we don't know who is even behind any kind of shenanigans, if, in fact, there are shenanigans. But obviously, when you hear that the FBI is going to hold a major election security news conference for 4:30 our time, the assumption when you've got those players is that it is, in fact, serious. Now, this, of course, comes at a time where there is increased scrutiny on mail-in ballots. Mail-in getting record numbers across the country because of the coronavirus and, of course, increased interest in this particular election. But we can tell you that the reports coming in from NBC, Fox News, and CNN all indicating not just that this is going to be a serious or major election security news conference, but it was scheduled abruptly. The abrupt nature of it could mean that they just learned about this or whatever the issue happens to be. They spent considerable time in going after whomever is responsible, but were doing this, you know, in a way that was closely held to the vest, where that they didn't see the kind of leaks that we generally see when it comes to some of these issues. Now, what's interesting in all of this is also the timing of it, right? We've been getting word and story after story after story indicating that, in fact, there is a significant increase in voter turnout. That means a lot more is on stake when it comes to the election security. And so a lot of people, a lot of check marks right now are anxiously awaiting why this major press conference would happen this close to the election day, this close to a debate, seemingly out of the blue. Now, some people are speculating that it could potentially be damaging to Joe Biden. The only reason they're saying that, to give you context, is that it is reminding a lot of people about the James Comey press conference, which was close to the actual start of the election that hurt Hillary Clinton. Here is the FBI press
Attorney
briefing.
General for National Security, John Demers, and also Director Chris Krebs for the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, or CISA. There will be no questions. Thank you. This is your 2-minute warning.
Okay. So we just got a 2-minute warning that this is going to happen. Like we said, there are some big names a part of this, including, of course, the FBI director and Christopher Wray. And, of course, as you just heard there, that was John Demers. He's the Assistant Attorney General for National Security, but also expected to be there as the Director of National Intelligence, John Ratcliffe. we'll find out what this quote-unquote major election security news issue happens to be. But this did come out of nowhere, and there is a lot of speculation that this could be yet another October surprise. And all of that right now is pure speculation. Because it was so abrupt, this news did not leak, at least not as best as I can tell, as to the substance of this particular press conference. So if you're just joining us, this, by the way, is another good reason to have the KTTH smartphone app, because when we have breaking news stories, you end up getting an alert, as people are getting right now on the app. We can tell you there is a major election security news conference that is about to get underway coming from the FBI. Right now, they're taking to the podium. Here is the assistant Attorney General on National Security.
Cycle. With everything on the line, it kind of feels strangely familiar to 4 years ago.
Should be coming in right about now, courtesy of Fox News.
In our republic, then the fundamental democratic principle of one person, one vote. It is our duty to ensure the sanctity of U.S. elections. That includes ensuring the security of voting systems. The intelligence community's role is to identify threats and to assess the intentions, capabilities, and actions of foreign adversaries. Our duty also includes empowering the American people to understand information, or perhaps more accurately, disinformation, that they are seeing, particularly on the internet, and make informed decisions for themselves. With that in mind, we would like to alert the public that we have identified that two foreign actors, Iran and Russia, have taken specific actions to influence public opinion relating to our elections. First, we have confirmed that some voter registration information has been obtained by Iran and separately by Russia. This data can be used by foreign actors to attempt to communicate false information to registered voters that they hope will cause confusion, sow chaos, and undermine your confidence in American democracy. To that end, we have already seen Iran sending spoofed emails designed to intimidate voters, incite social unrest, and damage President Trump. You may have seen some reporting on this in the last 24 hours, or you may have even been one of the recipients of those emails. Additionally, Iran is distributing other content to include a video that implies that individuals could cast fraudulent ballots, even from overseas. This video and any claims about such allegedly fraudulent ballots are not true. These actions are desperate attempts by desperate adversaries. Even if the adversaries pursue further attempts to intimidate or attempt to undermine voter confidence, know that our election systems are resilient, and you can be confident your votes are secure. Although we have not seen the same actions from Russia, we are aware that they have obtained some voter information just as they did in 2016. Rest assured that we are prepared for the possibility of actions by those hostile to democracy. The great women and men of the intelligence community caught this activity immediately, and our colleagues at FBI and DHS acted swiftly in response to this threat. We are standing before you now to give you the confidence that we are on top of this and providing you with the most powerful weapon we have to combat these efforts, the truth, information. We ask every American to do their part to defend against those who wish us harm. The way you do that is quite simple. Do not allow these efforts to have their intended effect. If you receive an intimidating or manipulative email in your inbox, don't be alarmed and do not spread it. This is not a partisan issue. I've had conversations today with members of Congress from both sides of the aisle, and there is complete unanimity in the U.S. government in our resolve to combat the enemies of freedom. The president has instructed me to keep the public informed as appropriate, and you have my commitment that I will continue to do exactly that with transparency and with candor. We will not tolerate foreign interference in our elections, and we will continue to work with our many partners to disrupt and to impose costs and consequences on any adversary that attempts to interfere in our democratic processes. The efforts of the president to empower us to put towards election security over these last 4 years are working. I'll now turn it over to my colleague, Director Wray of the FBI, to address law enforcement's activities.
That was John Ratcliffe, the Director of National Intelligence. And as you heard, here's FBI Director Christopher Wray.
The FBI is the primary agency responsible for investigating malicious cyber activity against election infrastructure, malign foreign influence operations, and election-related crimes like voter fraud and voter suppression or intimidation. And that's exactly what we've been doing. At the FBI, we're working closely with our intelligence community partners, as well as our other federal, state, and local partners, to share information, bolster security, and identify and disrupt any threats. We are not going to tolerate foreign interference in our elections or any criminal activity that threatens the sanctity of your vote or undermines public confidence in the outcome of the election. When we see indications of foreign interference or federal election crimes, we're going to aggressively investigate and work with our partners to quickly take appropriate action. We're also coordinating with the private sector, both technology and social media companies, to make sure that their platforms aren't used by foreign adversaries to spread disinformation and propaganda. We've been working for years as a community to build resilience in our election infrastructure, and today, that infrastructure remains resilient. You should be confident that your vote counts. Early, unverified claims to the contrary should be viewed with a healthy dose of skepticism. We encourage everyone to seek election and voting information from reliable sources, namely your state election officials, and to be thoughtful, careful, and discerning consumers of information online. And if you suspect criminal activity, we ask that you report that information to your local FBI field office. As always, the men and women of the FBI remain committed to protecting the American people, our democracy, and the integrity of our elections. We are not going to let our guard down. Thank you.
That's Christopher Wray, FBI director. They're now all walking off of the stage. The big announcement at this hastily, or we should say abruptly called press conference from members not just of the FBI, but also we heard from John Ratcliffe at the start from the National Intelligence, came out to say, confirming that Iran and Russia are, in fact, taking actions right now to influence public opinion. In fact, they are put out there to help defeat President Trump, according to these reports. They have confirmed that voter information registration had been obtained by Iran and Russia. They have already seen Iran sending spoofed emails designed to intimidate voters, create civil unrest, and again, actively hurt President Trump in his reelection campaign. We got some details specifically that Iran was sending out videos implying individuals could cast fraudulent ballots from overseas, plus some kind of intimidating emails. On top of that, they say they have not seen the same actions yet from Russia, but they have obtained voter information, voter registration information, and they said that they caught the activity immediately over at the FBI and the Department of Homeland Security, and they wanted to come out today to provide confidence in the election process. Now, I imagine there are going to be some folks on Twitter who will say that the only reason they're coming out is to help Donald Trump. But when you have Christopher Wray, who several times have sort of butted heads publicly with the president, or I suppose vice versa, should help quell some of the concerns over political motivation in that announcement. Again, they're not saying that any vote has been illegally cast. They're saying there is an intimidation factor that's happening right now that they've been able to confirm. Obviously, as more of this information comes out, we will deliver it to you live. Welcome back to the Jason Rantz Show, live on this Wednesday afternoon. Just moments ago, we heard a press briefing from the FBI, from the Director of National Intelligence, specifically about influence and interference on our election system by Iran and Russia. It's not quite an October surprise in a traditional sense, but it is rather interesting in the moves, in this case by Iran and Russia, to go after Donald Trump. Because we heard for so long that foreign interference was meant to help Donald Trump, particularly when Russia is involved. And yet in this case, it's been confirmed, according to both DNI's John Ratcliffe, Director of National Intelligence, and the Director of FBI, in Christopher Wray, that they have confirmed voter information registration has been obtained by both of those foreign countries, foreign entities, and they've already seen some interference. They say they saw Iran sending spoofed emails that are designed to intimidate voters into, presumably, because they're saying this is all in an effort to hurt Donald Trump, to not vote for him. There is an effort ongoing to create civil unrest, which, of course, would be taking advantage of the civil unrest that we've already been seeing in this country associated with the sort of the Antifa and agitator criminal activists. They say that Iran was caught sending out video implying individuals could cast fraudulent votes overseas as well. And again, all in an effort to hurt President Trump. Now, they say they haven't seen the same actions from Russia as they've seen from Iran. It sounds like Iran has been considerably more active in their attempt to disrupt the American election. But they say Russia has, in fact, obtained voter information. What the voter information is was not discussed during this press briefing. We can infer, at least if email addresses have been used to get some of these intimidating notes, presumably they're collecting email addresses. But obviously, you know that if you're going after the email address, it's possible that you're going after other personal and identifiable information like your address and phone number, which just has some implications as far as the potential for voter fraud is concerned. However, they are saying that not a single vote has been compromised. Now, what's interesting is, you know, in this effort to create the civil unrest, it appears as of right now that one piece of the quote unquote fake news that was put out there was actually amplified by the Lincoln Project, which is an anti-Trump group of Never Trump Republicans. And they had linked to what appears to be one of the fraudulent stories where they claim the Proud Boys are attempting to scare voters away from the polls. And they claim that this is a story coming out of Florida, and they link to it. One of the emails comes from officialproudboys.com, and this appears to be the fraudulent email. It says, "Hi," and they say your name. "We're in possession of all your information. You're currently registered as a Democrat, and we know this because we have gained access into the voting infrastructure. You will vote for Trump on election day, or we will come after you." So this is the kind of stuff that obviously would hurt President Trump, because it sounds like he's the one intimidating them. But it turns out that is nonsense. More of this coverage when we come back.